This is A Sustainable Mind, episode 34.
Don't think it's a far away or exotic thing, or you have to be deep in the woods. In fact, deep in the woods is the last place to look for food. Look around you. Look in your own civilized environment, and you'll find these little organisms that are despised by so many, but are actually full of nutrition and full of interest and full of good taste.
Welcome to A Sustainable Mind, where we delve into the minds behind today's most impactful environmental campaigns, organizations, and startups, inspiring the environmental changemakers of tomorrow. I'm your host, Marjorie Alexander. Today, I am so excited to be speaking with Mallory O'Donnell, writer of the blog, How to Cook a Weed. A fantastic resource for aspiring foragers and local foodies alike, showing you how to make the most of rare, inexpensive, and wild ingredients. Mallory takes you on adventures in rural New Jersey, sharing experiences with wild ingredients and recipes entirely concocted from items found in the backyard, garden, or on long walks around the neighborhood. Mallory, welcome to the show. I am so excited to have you on. I've been checking out your blog for the last couple months, How to Cook a Weed, and it's so interesting. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you. Thanks so much for reaching out to me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I want to start off getting to know a little bit about how nature, the environment, and sustainability played a role in your home or your life growing up. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, sure thing. I think my folks were always fairly ecologically conscious growing up. We were big early recyclers, and in general, those kind of ideas were floating around. But my focus, I think, early on was with nature. And it was, I think I turned to nature sort of as a contraindicative thing to what was going on in the world, or what I perceived as the world around me, which, not that it was so negative or bad, but I never felt very comfortable with a modern sort of lifestyle in a certain way. Mm-hmm. I think very early on, it struck me as kind of wasteful. And but I think my real embrace of nature was as a sort of, I don't want to say escape route, because it sounds a little negative, more like a vessel for feelings that I had that I couldn't express in conventional ways. So I became really interested in literature that was reflective of it. I read a lot of the classics of ecology and stuff like that while I was in high school and then in college. And I always understood it, but I think I understood it more as an intellectual place and as a place to enjoy visually and experience. My real desire to understand it on a deeper level and really examine exactly what was happening in that space, I think, came much later.
Absolutely. So you are a professional in the landscaping industry. Can you tell us about exactly how that transition happened from your childhood, your young adulthood, into the industry that you work in right now?
Well, it's a family business. It's family owned and operated for almost 30 years now. And it's a very small business. We're not a big player. And it was always in the background. My dad started the business in the 80s. I worked as a kid growing up. I remember one of the first experiences I had, which I don't think I really recalled properly until much later, but my interest in sort of writing and in academic things, when I was working at a very early age in, I think, junior high, I remember pulling weeds at a property and thinking, does anybody know what these are? Is there a book about these? Does anybody care, you know, or are they just, you know, and obviously being sort of not really understanding things at that point, but that sort of must have laid dormant in my mind for a really long time. So it was always in the background, but I pursued a lot of other interests and really wanted to move around the country a bit. I went to school in New England, at Hampshire, in Amherst, Massachusetts. And I lived there for a little while after I graduated. Then I moved to Virginia, and then I moved to Houston, Texas. So I traveled around a lot. I kept looking for a change in my environment. And a broader group of people and a greater diversity of people. It's always been part of my feeling that this area where I live is a little narrow in its perspective. There's not a lot of variety of people and variety of experiences to be had. So I wasn't working in the business for that period. 2011 would be when I came back here. after living in Houston for about 6 years or 5 years, I should say. In that time, I was I worked as a rare record and book buyer for different stores back when we had record stores.
Yeah, I feel you on that one. We have Amoeba here in Los Angeles, and I think that they have a couple other stores in California. But you're right, totally a dying breed, unfortunately. Except the hipsters are bringing it back, sort of.
Yeah. I mean, it's better looking situation now than it was in the early 2000s and mid 2000s when I was doing it. That's for sure.
Very good.
It was really looking pretty grim there. So.
So not long after 2011, when you did come back to the business, you also started your blog, How to Cook a Wheat, where you focus on cooking, gardening, foraging, and just overall living a wonderful life, but not on a ton of money. Can you tell us a bit about why you started that blog and what experiences you've had with your readers since then?
Absolutely. It really arose out of Instagram. That was where I started documenting what I was doing. And I think at first I was documenting it for myself. I don't think I'm not a great hashtagger. I'm not good at pushing my agenda on social media. It's really from an innate desire simply to record what I'm doing and what's happening because I found it kind of interesting. And then I realized that, you know, other people felt the same way. I just became really immersed in it. There was, a couple of changes took place after I moved here. You know, home life changes and things like that, and just attitude changes. And I started incorporating a lot more wild food into what I was already doing, which is kind of a cultural melange of peasant and grandmother cooking. I've always made really simple, earthy, hearty foods and tried to be very local from what I collected and cooked with. And then it just kind of, there was a point at which I said, you know, I really should just eat my environment and not look outside it, not even if I get a creative idea, you know, I shouldn't necessarily pursue it if it involves, why don't I take that creative idea and see if I can work with something that's here in front of me. And somewhere in the midst of that, you know, it started as kind of that idea, but I think what drew me there was the flavors, just the fact that this food has such a distinctive characteristic stamp of time and place. It's a much abused notion now, but terroir, it's what my neighborhood tastes like because everything's from here.
Right. So I have been following you on Instagram for a while, but I did not realize that you have over 11,300 posts. So when you said it started on Instagram, I'm thinking 2012, like, was Instagram even around back then? And it was. Obviously, you were like the first user because you have 11,000 posts.
You know what? It's it's not even that long ago. I think I'll be in my fourth year this summer on Instagram. Yeah, well, what I try to do is there's a lot of I want to write about more about applying the plants. I'm not really interested in like making a field guide or anything like that. But Instagram sort of can be a field guide or at least a help, an addition to that, although I really counsel against people using it as an exclusive source. But the thing is, every March 30th, you know, you'll get a flash of what's going on out there right now. And that's why there are so many posts, because I'm not posting once about dandelions. I'm posting about dandelions every time I collect them and every stage of their growth. Like in the winter, I occupy myself with doing bark studies. I go to trees that I know that I collect food from or that are just interesting trees, and I get a really nice capture of the bark, and you'll see three or four of them every day usually.
Yeah.
And it's just it is like a diary. And the best part is looking back and going, not only is it helpful to see where I've come or what new things I've learned, but also that I can, it's very helpful in terms of just the schedule of eating wild food. You see something when you collected something and you go, oh my God, I got to get to that tree right now. You know, it's ready again or whatever. So it's helpful like that too. But it did start as kind of a journal.
So I do have to ask, and just to go back for a second, anyone that is interested in visiting Mallory's Instagram, it is Mallory L. O'Donnell, at Mallory L. O'Donnell on Instagram. And like I said, over 11,000 posts. Insane. The textures, the flavors, the colors are so fascinating on here. And obviously, this is from your local environment. Where are you located aroundabouts?
I'm in Western New Jersey, which might not be readily apparent for a lot of people that think New Jersey is a big cityscape. I live in a very farm, a lot of farms, a lot of preserved land. When I left here in 2001, I expected, when I came back 10 years later, I had visited, I think, once or twice, but I expected a great change in the landscape, and there really hasn't been. It's a commuter neighborhoods. A lot of people come out here to have kids we have a fairly good school system, but it's a lot of people that work in for big corporations and commute, and then a lot of preserved land, a lot of open space, and quite a few farms. The farm situation here is, it's a lot of agribusiness type stuff, but there's also some good local farms, and they're really starting to bring it back because the landscape itself hasn't really changed that much over the last 10 years, which is a good thing.
So I have to ask, because I know, well, there are several people that I know personally that will listen to this episode and think foraging. How do you know what the heck you're eating? And of course, to get super dramatic about it, how do you not die? But but really, I know that there are several foods that if you don't cook them can, you know, be upsetting to your stomach, or several foods that have something that looks very similar that can be, you know, that's basically not edible for humans, at least. How do you get around that? And you said earlier that you try to be careful about saying people should only use Instagram as their field guide and maybe incorporate some other sources for what to eat in their local environments. How do you educate yourself about what's around you, what's edible and what's not?
Well, the first thing I think is you want to have multiple sources, not photo sources. You need to find a mixture of media, both photographs, drawings, and text, field guides. There's a lot of good books out there. I'd be happy to send you a bibliography or whatever if you'd like.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
That's part of what I want to do in the future, both with the website and with what I'm working on, is to sort of unite the resources that are out there. But my real big piece of advice would be use as many resources as possible. If you have a person who knows the plants, that's obviously the first and best resource. If there's someone in your area or an experienced forager, there's a lot of foraging guides that offer themselves. Some are free, some are not. And if you have a mushroom club, those are good. I'm in the New Jersey Mycological Society. I definitely recommend joining one of those if you're curious about mushrooms, because mushrooms are a landmine of a lot of toxic species that are very common, as with plants. The question everyone always asks is, how do you know what to eat and how do you not get sick? But the only way to really do that is to really understand what something is before you put it in your mouth. Mm-hmm. Take your time. Don't be keen to see something look like a photo and match it and go, oh, that's what that is. I'm gonna take that home and cook it tonight, because that's not what's gonna happen. You've got to watch it. Compare it with multiple sources if you can. A really good thing for herbaceous plants or weeds is you want to see the plant flower. A lot of plants look really similar when they're just green leaves. Mm-hmm. But when they flower, you get a lot closer to an identification of them. And a lot of the field guides that are available are going to focus on the flowers. So that's helpful. There's a lot of really good resources on plant identification. I think I use Instagram a bit to express my aspect of that, or my need to help people along with that. But my interest is more in taking those materials that are out there, helping people sort of sift through them, and then what to do with it when you have it, because that's really what's not well documented, is the cooking aspect of this and the food use aspect of it isn't as well documented or put together in terms of the resources that are out there.
So I want to get a little bit more into the topics that you cover in your blog specifically. What are some of your favorite recipes that you've shared with your readers online?
I really like making, I don't even want to call it not necessarily recipes, but I like making pantry items. I like making fermented foods, brewing wild teas, using those as ingredients in cooking. Most of my cooking itself is sort of ad hoc and thrown together. It's really simple food. but I have an endless amount of resources that I can play with because I use these ingredients to create sort of more, to try and go for more creative applications with them. They become more like pantry items, freezer items. I really like to encourage people to try and use acorns and process acorns. There's a huge bounty of those, which doesn't all have to be set aside for wildlife. There is a sustainability to acorn harvesting as long as you do it in the right fashion. I don't know. I think some of the more inspired things that I've done have been more about taking something that doesn't necessarily get much use in the wild food community as an edible. Like a good example would be hemlock cones. Now, hemlock cones are edible, but no one really uses them because they taste so intense. Mm-hmm. But when you grind them up and make a salt, or you dry them and make a sugar, or dry them even further, they become almost like seaweed in flavor, and you can make things like furikake from them, and you know, use them as it's almost seaweed from a tree. But when they're fresh, they have a very citrusy flavor, which you can capture in a salt and season something with, and it becomes some new flavor that you've never really had. But it's something that if you picked it up and ate it off the tree, you would probably not want to cook, you know, immediately gather a ton of them. So I've tried to stress some of the more unconventional ingredients and trying to make culinary gold out of them, if you would, like making stocks where you incorporate bark. One of my favorite things I make is just called the broth of fallen leaves. And it's food safe leaves that are either browning on the tree or fallen, and you know, you clean them up, you can put them in a pot, add water, and you create a broth that's almost mushroomy, earthy, rich and deep. You know, you get the right flavor balance in there, and it has a really shocking flavor that you wouldn't necessarily expect just from a bunch of literally scattered fall leaves.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, where you are now in your journey with foraging and cooking the world around you, basically, hence the name, How to Cook a Weed, that has required a fairly intense amount of study over the years. How would you suggest that someone get started with foraging or started with, you know, something that they just have in their backyard? Maybe they're not going too far out into parks or the nature around them, but something just in their backyard that they know is edible. For a beginner, how would you suggest that they bring those items in and start working with them?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with the question right there. The best place to start is your backyard or your front yard, or if you're in the city, a local park, or even what's growing through the the cracks in the sidewalk. I don't want you to eat what's growing through the cracks in the sidewalk, but if you look at the plants, if you observe the plants, you're going to start to see them everywhere. Plant ID is a very complicated thing in terms of going about it from your own ground level. But if you've got enough resources and perhaps a little guidance along the way, once you see that plant, then you start to be able to unravel the mysteries of the other ones. And then once you've seen something, you realize that it's everywhere, because most of the plants that are edible are introduced by humans, and they're the common weeds that grow in the sidewalk, that grow in your front yard, or especially in your garden. That's actually, if anyone has a garden, I always steer them there first, because most of the plants that pop up in your garden they're not only edible, but when you would want to weed them to make way for your other plants is when they're at the peak of their edibility. When you want to collect dandelions is right when they pop out of the ground in spring. Pull the whole plant out of your garden, roast the roots or dry the roots, and make a seasoning salt with it. Eat the fresh leaves. They're delicious at first. They get more bitter later on, but you can cook them a bit. And it's kind of ironic that people will pull these, you know, so quote-unquote weeds out of their gardens and then just throw them in the compost pile. Well, hopefully they'll throw them in the compost pile.
Right. Last year, I gave up my community plot because I just couldn't get there enough, but had a community garden plot, and I had tons of dandelions. And so I experimented with using the roots in teas, fresh. I didn't dry them or anything. And it was quite tasty. I was really surprised. Or combine that with mint to make a mint dandelion tea. It's actually really, really good. What are some other super simple ones that are maybe very common that people might be able to look out for?
Well, definitely chickweed is a big one, because it comes out in the fall often, especially in more urban poor, I guess, you know, civilized areas and towns, and especially I see chickweed all the time in the planter pots of you know, different little local businesses and towns around here. That's a good one, and it comes out again in the spring, and it's a very distinctive in the way it grows. It grows like a dense mat. It's not very similar looking to too many other plants. It doesn't have a lot of toxic lookalikes. It flowers fairly early. It's something that people can eat raw, which I think people enjoy when they start working with wild plants, because a lot of them require a little bit of preparation, or they become a lot better if you prepare them. But that's a good one to start with. Purslane is another very common, that comes out a little later in the year towards the summer. Very difficult to mistake for other things. It's almost succulent, like a aloe plant, but smaller, and tends to grow in city gardens very healthfully because it grows very well in poor soil. That's a great plant. You see it a lot in farmers markets in the city when it's in season. It has the highest concentration of omega-3 of any plant on earth.
Wow.
Really nutritious, yeah. Lamb's quarters is another common one. Very distinctive. It's looks like spinach a bit, but it's downy and covered with a soft hair. Grows in a very characteristic kind of way, so it's sort of tough to mistake, and it's everywhere. It's a very common plant of disturbed ground and of your garden and your space like that. Those are some of the best things to start with. The other thing I think that doesn't get enough push, especially for early foragers, is trees, because trees are really difficult to misidentify. Mm-hmm. They have so many different characteristics you can look at, from their bark, which is there all year round, to the buds, which might come out in fall or winter or spring. They flower. Every tree flowers, even if you don't really notice the flowers. They're there. And then, of course, the leaves, which are, you know, there for most of the year. Even the way the leaves change color is distinctive. You know, certain hickories turn a very bright orange yellow. You get to know the trees and you're going to suddenly realize that there's a lot of edible things going on there. And they're largely sustainable. They're parts that you can use without really doing much damage to the tree. You don't have to uproot a tree to eat acorns or to eat black walnuts, which, you know, I see literally probably hundreds of thousands of black walnuts just sitting on people's lawns, rotting all year long around here. And even really obvious fruits like apples. There are tons of apple trees which were planted here in people's yards, and people have gotten accustomed to this sort of fear of things that are natural, that they won't eat apples that are, you know, the common misconception is that abandoned apple is full of worms.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. I've cut open hundreds of apples every year, and you really don't find a lot. Usually you see the worm when it's out of the apple and there's a hole.
yeah. But,
I think most people don't collect them because they don't look like supermarket apples, and people are afraid that they'll be made sick by something because it wasn't sprayed. But I think it might be the other way around.
Hmm. That's such an interesting point. Yeah, apples that aren't shiny enough, which, by the way, before the apple gets to you, if it's shiny, sometimes they shine it with natural stuff and other times they shine it with plastic, BPA, actually. Yeah. So that's something to chew on, something to sleep on, which is a little disturbing. But yeah, I mean, if the apple isn't round enough or shiny enough or red enough or green enough, you know, it can definitely scare some people off, which is unfortunate. So I'm glad that there are people like you out there doing the work of increasing curiosity about natural ingredients that are out there that we can take advantage of for free, that are just in our backyards or around town, things that we pass every day, and help us see the beauty in those things and actually incorporate those things into our lives in various ways. So thank you so much for that.
Wow. That makes it sound like what I do is important. That's really...
It is important.
That's wonderful. I think that we need, all of us, I think as a species, we need a major category shift in terms of how we think about things. And I think food is a good way to start for some people, because it's immediately gratifying. You taste something wild that you collect yourself. Not only is the experience itself healthy and positive because you're not walking in the woods or you're cleaning up your garden or whatever, but you also come out with something that maybe creates a taste that you didn't know was out there, and it can really inspire you to do more things like that. But I think most of all, it just it's so honest. It comes from the place we are. And a lot of times it we put it there. I mean, all these apple trees were planted by people that wanted to eat apples. Mm-hmm. They didn't anticipate we would just let them rot on lawns because they're not, you know, golden delicious.
Isn't that the actual name of the apple, golden delicious, is like a... I don't know if that's the name that the company gave the apple or if it's the name of that specific. I don't know. But yeah, I've seen that in apple catalogs or whatever.
It's the cultivar, and it's, you know, it's one of the lamest apples in the world. A lot of, the old abandoned orchard apples have a lot more flavor and a lot more interesting things going on with them. Yeah, it's staggering in a way how quickly our adjustment to a very mechanized, very processed food source has happened. It's only really been, you know, the matter of 100 years or so that we've really gone full gear. And it's really only a matter of since the 50s that America really went over the top and just everything we eat is processed. I think that's always one of the things that makes me laugh a bit when people say, how do you not poison yourself? And which I know, I think is a very legitimate question. Don't get me wrong. The first thing is that I learn what's poisonous before I learn what I can eat. That was the first thing I said, where's my hemlock? Where is that? Because that's going to kill you instantly. I mean, it's not a pleasant thing. But, you know, when I put something in my mouth, I know where it grew. I knew what the soil it grew in was. I know what the botanical name of the plant is. I would venture that most people are walking home from the supermarket with packages that have things in them they can't even pronounce, much less know what it is. And that's really very different way to think about things. Like, I'm not saying I don't ever eat a processed food. I don't want to be joyless. I live in New Jersey. I'm going to have a slice of pizza when I want to.
Well, I could not have said it better. Oh my goodness gracious. Well, I want to get into our 7 sustainable questions here, if you're ready.
Absolutely.
And the first of which is, can you share with us one long-standing habit that you believe has significantly positively impacted your life?
Definitely. Walking. Human beings don't walk enough anymore. Our bodies evolved over time to be primarily machines for walking. And I think some people would say climbing. But walking is sort of how we observed the world for a really long time. We walked, we encountered things, we observed them, we studied them, we learned what they were. Now we, you know, are constantly flying past them in machines or, you know, riding machines on our way to work, getting about in a much more mechanized way, which I think is really a fundamental change in how we observe the world. And I think that I learned to love walking. I don't know. No one likes it as much as me. I really learned to love it at an early age, and I'm always forever walking everywhere. I really encourage it because it forces you to operate on nature's time a little bit and to observe things a little more slowly. And it's just a practice that I think I try to do it every day. You know, I certainly do it every day, but I try to get outside and do it every day too, not just walk around the house brewing kettles of sweet birch tea, but also get outside and move around. I also think that it's a very helpful tool if you're trying to understand the edible world, because you will see the same things every day, and then you'll learn how they change and how they evolve over time and how they grow during the year, which is very important if you want to understand them.
Awesome. What is one new habit that you're cultivating in your life right now?
Okay, this is one of my favorite creations. Actually, I should have thought of it when you asked earlier, but I have always had a really irregular behavior pattern with coffee. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it, but I'm not a coffee addict. I don't have to have it every day. And while I enjoyed making wild teas and things like that, and I've experimented with all different kinds, the thing that I really started doing last year that has meant made a big difference, I think, in terms of my impact would be I started making, it's like a kombucha, but instead of using the cultivated tea leaves, I use the leaves of any of the rubus species. Now, rubus is the cane fruit, so it's blackberry, raspberry, wineberry, all those guys, the native black raspberry here, all those plants. They all have leaves that, when dried, are they taste remarkably like tea, but they also have the same energy in them that allows them to create a kombucha. So I make a rubucha is what I call it, because it can be any of those leaves from that genus. I usually use the wild blackberry leaves. They have a really nice flavor. And then wineberry, which is extremely invasive. It's one of our most invasive plants. It's a Asiatic berry that was introduced sometime in the 20th century, and it's completely taken over a lot of the woods around here. So I use the leaves from that and make a beverage that is essentially, you know, it's like a kombucha, but it's just flavored with plants that are in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love coffee, I love tea, and we've come a long way with fair trade and things like that. But you're at the end of the day, you're still consuming a plant that comes from the tropics. I mean, it's going to have a ticket on it, you know?
Absolutely. What is one item that you've purchased or acquired in the last year that has helped you live a more earth-conscious lifestyle?
This was the hardest one. I couldn't really think of it. I think a dehydrator, and I had a dehydrator, but I got a better dehydrator. It's a small thing, and it obviously it burns energy. But the thing is, it's so perfect to create a whole set of foodstuffs that not only have different flavors that I can experiment with, it changes the flavors of them. It also gives me a really big stock of things that I can eat in the winter, because there's not a whole lot going on out there. Well, I always say there's a lot going on in the winter and people don't know it, but it really helps to create a larder, or to create a more sustainable winter food source, because I can, you know, I've got tons of mushrooms that I can rehydrate. I've got, you know, the different leaves and spices that I use, lots of nuts, lots of acorns. And I think that, you know, it's a techno gizmo, but I think it gives back a lot more than it takes. Does that work, or is it too?
No, that totally works. I think dehydrators are awesome, and they also, I think, help preserve some of the nutritious parts of the food we eat. Sometimes you cook things and you cook all the nutritious stuff right out of it. So, I don't know the science behind that. So don't take my word for it. Read some blog by somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. But I do believe that that is the case. So this is a new question, new for 2018, that I'm trying out, and we'll see how it goes. So I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball. Hope you don't mind. So what is one misstep that you've had in your journey so far that has taught you something invaluable?
Wow, good question. I really am very... sort of try to always look at everything as a step in the journey. So I even a misstep to me is a step that you needed to make to be inaccurate. But that's what you're really asking.
Yes.
And that's a really clever question, which makes it harder.
You're welcome.
It's good. I think not, and I hope it's a good answer. I hope it's sort of appropriate, but I was very afraid of foraging mushrooms for a really long time. I've come much more recently around to them. And I think that the lesson I learned was that when you study something deeply, whether it's art or music or plants, the skill set is there for you to study the next thing just as deeply. And being afraid or intimidated by them because I felt like I was doing it on my own, I didn't reach out to them sooner. And I really wish I had, because adding that dimension to my understanding has almost completed a picture of understanding at least the basics and fundamentals of the natural world around me, because they're the sort of missing element. They're the overlooked element. You know, they're what decomposes most of what goes on out there. And they tie it all together in a way that plants don't. You know, they're very curious. They're more closely related, genetically speaking, they're more closely related to us than they are to plants. They're much more like animals. And I think not realizing that because of fear, and not understanding that because of fear, probably held me back in a certain way. And that would be, you know, something I would think. But I think the lesson of learning that has made me, once I realized mushrooms aren't very scary at all, or they're no more scary than plants, I should say, I realized that there's sort of nothing like left to worry about or be afraid of. No reason to have any other big hang-ups about something.
Excellent. Thank you for bearing with me there.
No problem. It's a really good question. And it's typical of what you're asking, which is stuff that provokes you to think a bit about what you're doing rather than just keep doing it.
Do you have an internet resource other than your website, which I'll plug in a few minutes, that you find helpful on a regular basis that you think most listeners would find beneficial?
Absolutely. I use this as a resource for foraging in terms of determining the edibility of plants. Also for a resource, just for a reference resource, learning about, for instance, you know, the 300 different kinds of clovers that are out there. But there's a site called Plants for a Future, PFAF.org, and it's primarily a horticultural project. It started a couple in Cornwall in the UK, started it as part of their sustainable garden, and it's become an online database with about 7,000 plants on it. Again, with the stressing the need to use more than one resource, I always take what's presented there with a hefty pinch of salt, as I would with any one source, especially one that is edited by a group of people. It's like Wikipedia. You have to, you know, you can't just use Wikipedia. And PFAF in some ways is a kind of Wikipedia for edible and medicinal and sustainable plants. They research the different horticultural aspects of them, what zones they'll grow in, where they're growing. There's a few things I think they could add to spice it up, but I mean, right now it's the most incredible resource that there is for just having a database of nearly every wild plant that you would maybe consider putting in your mouth. You can pretty much guarantee it's going to be on there. I would make sure that you compared with another source and not just go by what they say, but what they say is usually quite helpful. They will always report any indications of toxins in any particular plant, so you can make sure that you're drawing something correctly. For instance, with an herb like melilo, which needs to be dehydrated properly, they'll hint you to the issues involved with that. And then they generally have a lot of great references with each plant, where the literature, where it all comes from. A lot of traditional folk uses, a lot of traditional edible uses, and medicinal uses will be indexed there.
Awesome. Very cool resource. I'm definitely going to take a look at that when we get off of the call here. What is one book that you would recommend for sustainable minds out there that are hoping to shift their mindset specifically to become the change that they want to see in the world?
I thought about this one a lot, too. And there are a lot of great foraging books out there. And again, I'm happy to send you a little bit more of an index. But a book I always turn people onto is more about simple living. And it's called Honey from a Weed. It's by a British woman named Patience Gray. It emerged in 1986, probably the nadir of anyone caring about wild food or indeed simple food. It was really, you know, Not an auspicious time for her to publish it, but she was a woman who wrote about food and then ended up falling in love with a sculptor who traveled through southern Italy, Catalonia, and the Greek islands in search of marble quarries. So she traveled with him as he went to these places to get marble to work on sculptures, because there's only a certain number of marble quarries in Europe. And in each place, she learned how the local people prepared food. There's some wild food in there. There's a little bit of everything, fish, meat, game, and always the stresses on very simple dishes. Oftentimes she would have, you know, nothing more than a one burner. There's just something so elegant and beautiful about the way in which this book represents a complete lifestyle that when you read it, you're taken away and you want to live in a half ramshackle hut in, you know, in southern Italy somewhere and make these, you know, incredibly fresh sardine dishes or whatever it is. And she does incorporate wild food. She's very similar to me in that she makes peasant mermaid, you know, sort of peasant food with a twist of wild ingredients, and especially with the fresh greens and weeds that grew in the area. But it's also a recording of a real simple way of life that I think probably was very much disappearing while she was recording it. And I think that the beauty of it and the simplicity of it, I think, encourage anyone I know who's read it to turn a little bit more inward and live a little bit more simply and honestly with what's around them.
Awesome. And finally, it's been a long journey for you start to finish. Well, finish, I mean, nothing's really finished, is it?
No.
But if you had to create the same level of a following that you have with howtocookaweed.com, what fundamentals or tools, resources, and connections would you put in place right away to ensure that you made it to this place that you're at? And I want to preface this with, like you said, you weren't really doing this to with the intention of making a blog that thousands of people were going to read every month. It really started out as more something for you that you then began to share with the global community. And I, for one, totally appreciate that. And I know that you have a lot of other readers that appreciate it as well. What are some of the things that you would have done earlier on to kind of get to where you are right now with the website?
I think, and I feel in some ways almost as though I'm in the time machine right now, because I feel like I'm telling myself this right now, which is I have an enormous body of things that are written that I've been using because I'm working very seriously this winter on a book. And that's my main focus. And in the time of doing that, I've really been, not, to be honest, in my opinion, a bit neglectful about posting more to the website and even to Instagram. That, you know, I could be saying more, doing more, but I'm sort of squirreling away nuggets or whatever. And I think I really need to share more of what I'm working on as I'm working on it and open up the process more. And I think I would probably tell myself to do that, to reach out more, to express more, but also in a larger sense, to reach out to other people more, not just to document it for my own self and for my own purposes and my own needs. But in the last year, I've met a number of people through the blog and Instagram that have changed my life, that are other wild food aficionados, that are restaurant people, that are experimental creative chefs, that are just good people. And I think I would probably have pushed myself to be more social with it and actually use it as a platform to engage more with people in the real world rather than simply just document what I'm doing and what I'm working on in a be less stubborn and less selfish about it, I think, and share more and not be afraid to put a foot wrong.
Excellent. Well said. Thank you for that. So before we end here, I wanted to once again plug the website, howtocookaweed.com. Which, like I said, where you share a lot about cooking, gardening, and foraging in your local environment of New Jersey, like you mentioned earlier. And also on Instagram, Mallory L. O'Donnell, spelled MallorylOdonnell. And yes, that's a lot of letters, of course. As always, I'll have all of these linked up in the show notes page for this episode. So you can just go ahead to asustainablemind.com and search Mallory, and that episode should pop up immediately. So Mallory, do you have any words or parting pieces of guidance for sustainable minds out there?
I think that it's a popular and trendy thing to talk about eating local, but I think to really do it takes a little bit of an extra step. I think that when you look around you, you should start to see not just innocuous plants in a green landscape, but something a little bit more complex. Most of what's out there is, if not edible, important to know about. The plants that are around us are largely there because of our influence. We put them there. All the little weeds you see growing along the roadside, those are all there because some human being in the recent past decided they were worth growing, probably to eat them. And I think that, don't think it's a far away or exotic thing, or you have to be deep in the woods. In fact, deep in the woods is the last place to look for food. Look around you. Look in your own civilized environment, and you'll find these little organisms that are despised by so many, but are actually full of nutrition and full of interest and full of good taste.
Hey there, Sustainable Minds. Are you connected with us on social media? Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to get links to the latest episodes, show notes pages, and cool environmental articles and current news. We are A Sustainable Mind on both Facebook and Instagram, and just Sustainable Mind on Twitter. We also have an email address if you'd like to get in touch one-on-one. Just email me at marjorie@asustainablemind.com. That is MarjorieAsustainableMind.com. or just visit the website and use the contact form. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on A Sustainable Mind.